thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And, you know, if extreme weather was a sport, we'd be winning it in the last few weeks. Headlines have been crowded with news of wildflower fires, hurricanes, a Midwest windstorm. And our weather guys are back to talk about it with us. That weather and climate information coming from Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve Ackerman, welcome back.
Hey, Larry, how's it going on this cool day?
It is a little cooler. Maybe it's a cool day.
Winter's coming.
John Martin with us as well. I think, John, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. How are you guys doing?
Good. Great to have you with us. John's a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences as well. So we've got a lot to talk about with the recent weather events, especially hurricane season in full force. So I hope you'll join in with your weather questions and observations. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And just to start us off on a lighter note here, let's talk about the phrase, the dog days of summer. Can you explain that?
The dog days of summer are certainly not what we're having today in Wisconsin. It's kind of cool.
Yes.
We often heard the term that's used to reference hot and humid weather in our area, and it generally occurs in July and early August. We typically may think of that as, you know, it's hot and humid and the dogs just like to lay around and not do anything. But actually the phrase comes back from Roman times and has to do with the star Sirius, which is also known as the dog star. And it's around this time of year where that begins to appear in the night sky. And so it got to be known as the dog days of summer in the sense that it would, like most faithful dogs, it'd be coming up and signaling warm, humid weather.
Very interesting. I did not know that. Well, Vern from Boyd called and was curious if you know what was the most powerful hurricane in history, specifically on the Gulf Coast.
I just looked this up the other day, and I can't remember the name, but I think...
You know, I did too, John, and I can't remember the name either.
Yeah, son of a gun. There was one that got down into the below 900 millibars, and I just can't remember what that storm was off the top of my head.
Do you remember when it occurred, or roughly?
The later hurricane of 1935 was a real disaster. I don't know if that's the one. Hurricane Rita from 2005 was also exceptionally intense, but I don't remember, no.
Yeah. Hurricane Wilmer, too, didn't that also?
Wilmer was way up on the list pressure. Also, that's right. Gilbert might have been the one that I'm thinking of.
Well, the most recent hurricanes on everybody's radar are Hurricane Marco and Hurricane Laura.
Yeah.
Talk about what we saw with those.
Laura was a remarkable storm in so many different ways. First of all, its intensity. The storm became a Category 4 hurricane in the day prior to landfall. Up to that point, it was Category 2, which I think means its top maximum winds were only about 105 or 114 miles per hour. But it rapidly intensified into a real monster of a storm for southwest Louisiana and northeast Texas, and ended up coming on shore as a Category 4. And Lake Charles, Louisiana, which is 30 miles from the coast, 30 miles from the coast, had a peak gust of 137 miles per hour. This is nearly unheard of. So a really intense storm, huge amounts of rain, of course, that's common. Probably lots of small-scale tornadoes when the storm comes on shore. The other remarkable aspect of Laura was the how well predicted it was by the National Hurricane Center. while it was still organizing as a tropical disturbance over Haiti, 1,500 miles away, the forecasts became unwaveringly accurate about where it was going to make landfall. They were off by 0.6 miles in their estimation of the landfall location, and the timing was precisely accurate, 87 hours ahead of time. That is exceptional. And I mentioned the paper today, that's the equivalent of sinking a 900-foot putt on the golf course, which doesn't even exist.
And flatly done quite frequently.
Yeah, just unbelievable. And to get it right on time, too, and that allowed one and a half million people to evacuate without issue, and I think really kept the loss of life as low as one could ever hope to expect for a storm of that magnitude. It was really remarkable.
Oh, that's amazing. I just got a note from producers here that Hurricane Wilma was the strongest Atlantic hurricane ever recorded. And from NPR, Hurricane Camille, which made landfall in 1969 near Waveland, Mississippi, is the most powerful storm to strike the Gulf Coast based on the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale, commonly used by meteorologists. So that was 1969, that one was.
Yeah.
Well, that was bad. But I tell you what was bad for the Midwest was the wind. Is it derecho? 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 Derecho that hit the Midwest about 2 weeks ago. Especially hard in Iowa. What is a derecho?
Derecho is a straight line wind storm. So it's a storm that originates as a thunderstorm generated event, and yet it has no tornadic, that is, rotational winds in it at all. It's just straight line winds in there. They can be as high as 150 miles per hour. I think they were well over 100 in places in central and eastern Iowa in that recent storm. And what happens in a derecho is quite different from what happens in a tornado. A tornado becomes tornado is a strong vortical storm. That is, the winds are rotating around a very small radius of rotation, and they get to be extremely intense in the immediate vicinity of the tornado. With a derecho, the winds are tapped, very high, strong winds are tapped from high elevation through the mixing that goes on in the thunderstorm environment. And those winds are brought down effectively from jet aircraft level right to the ground in the thunderstorm downdrafts. And those winds just spread out when they hit the ground in a straight line. And they do devastating damage. And the storms themselves, the thunderstorms that are usually producing or being carried along by these derecho-type straight-line wind events, move very fast. I think the thunderstorm line was moving at about 60 miles per hour in its own forward velocity. So the combination of it tapping very strong horizontal winds from higher elevations and the storm itself moving at extremely fast speeds really creates strong winds at the ground that, you know, they can rip the paint off a wall in some cases. So it was an absolutely devastating event.
Yeah, the peak wind with that derecho that went through Iowa was estimated at 140 miles per hour, which
unbelievable.
Which is category four hurricane.
Yep, that's right.
And it devastated the corn crop through a lot of the area that it went through.
Yeah, it's just terrible, terrible damage. A listener emailed wondering if a derecho is a new weather term. You usually hear straight line winds.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think it was a distinction that was made in the late 1800s by one of the weather bureau offices at the time, or signal service offices at the time. I forget his name now. Steve might remember. But he was making a big stink about, in Iowa, as it turns out, about the difference between rotary storms like tornadoes, and the word tornado couldn't even use it in official statements by the weather bureau, signal service, or weather service until about 1950, I think, or something like that. And and the difference between those and the extremely straight-line winds that he distinguished more than 100 years ago were a distinct type of event. Can't remember the guy's name. He was an officer in the Army, though, if I'm right.
Well, we can...
And it derives its name from a Spanish word meaning straight, whereas tornado derives its name from, I don't know if it's Spanish or Latin.
Yeah, that Spanish verb tornar is to spin, yeah.
Yeah.
Ron in Crandon, you have a question.
Yeah, hey guys. I was just wondering what's the mechanism that causes a hurricane to either create or not create a storm surge? It sounds like this one was really intense, but it didn't pull that big storm surge along.
You know what? That is an interesting question, Ron, and we are going to take that up. By golly, we will. We'll give our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, a chance to ponder that a bit. But we are going to take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. John and Steve will be with us right up till 12:30. So we'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back, and we'll take a shot at answering Ron's question. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at weather and climate. Lots to talk about with hurricanes, derechos, the hottest temperature ever in Death Valley, extreme weather all over the place. Steve Ackerman and John Martin back with us, professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve is also Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I want to go back to Ron in Crandon, who was wondering about the variability in damage versus the intensity of hurricanes. Steve or John, you want to comment on that?
Steve? Yeah, in terms of, what really does the most damage is the storm surge, which is the amount of water that comes rushing inland when the hurricane makes landfall. And the size of that is a function of the wind speed and duration, so how strong is the wind, and then the open water over which it flows. So it has an opportunity to be pushing a lot of water towards the shoreline. So going up the entire Gulf of Mexico, as an example, that's a big fetch to gather a lot of water and then push it inland. And then the other thing is also the state of the moon. The moon drives the tide. So if you have a full moon, for example, then the water level is normally higher. And so you'll get a more deeper surge inland just because the water is naturally higher because of the gravitational pull.
So, and those surges, it's like almost like a tsunami coming in, isn't it? Or it can be?
Yeah, it can come in. It's probably not quite as quick as a large tsunami anyway, but it can move in fast. Yeah, yep.
Oh, man.
I mean, the storm could be moving 30 miles per hour, so it's going to be moving in. Pushing the water at that rate as well, I would think.
I mentioned Death Valley, and earlier this month, Death Valley, California, may have recorded one of the planet's hottest air temperatures at 130 degrees. I guess it still needs to be verified. Why is it so darn hot in Death Valley? Which seems like a dumb question.
They've gotten close to that before. They've gotten really close to that before. So this is apparently just eked a little bit higher than what had previously been the record. When I was a boy, there was a story about a record in Libya, somewhere in the desert in Libya, where the temperature had been 134 or something. I guess that's been unable to be officially verified, which is what they're doing now at the Death Valley record. So that happened in a period of extraordinary warmth in the western United States, really unusual conditions on a number of fronts, but related to a big ridge that had built over the western United States of particularly unusual strength this late summer. And so it was just part of that story. But Death Valley is absolutely cloudless, bone dry, And so when the sun comes up and you're under already underneath pretty warm air, it's really easy to mix that warm air right down to the ground, and the ground is a little bit below sea level, so the pressure is high there. And all those things added in give it just a little bit of an edge compared to most other parts of the world to get to those extraordinary temperatures.
Yeah, for sure. And Well, Rich, John, they did.
They did try and look at that a record previously, right? Because this seems very familiar.
Yes. I don't think when I heard it was 130 was the warmest day ever, I thought, wait a minute. I remember reading the Guinness Book of World Records, and the all time high temperature was 134.3 or something in July 1916. And one of the places where it was registered was Death Valley. But perhaps there's been some concern about the sitting of that thermometer that recorded those temperatures, that and the place in Libya. I don't know. But they seem to have been overturned. You're right, because all of a sudden 130 is the warmest ever. The details of that dispute, I don't know.
And even 125 is pretty darn hot.
When it's
125 or 130, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, if you're in it, it's
hot. Who the record meteorologists really care, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
Oh, man. Well, now let's go to Rich in La Crescent, Minnesota. Hi, Rich.
Yes, gentlemen. At the end of every month, the climatologist or the weather radio will summarize the month, you know, how much rain, and it was this temperature and that temperature, and it was the third hottest on record or so on. But I never hear anything about humidity. You know, this summer, I recall the dew point being greater than 75 many times. Do you have any handle as to how humid it was this summer?
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't really have a good answer for that. I know that I've had the same. Well, certainly last week was notable for anybody in the southern part of our own state. It was persistently humid beyond anything we experienced all summer long. You know, usually we get periods of 2 or 3 days of that kind of dew points over 70, and then they recede a little bit, and then they can come back. You can have a long month where you keep getting visited that way. But we had a 5 or 6 straight day period of that recently, and that's somewhat unusual for the southern part of Wisconsin. But that's a really good point, that generally speaking, the humidity level is not something that is a standout first order characteristic that people recall, you know, with measurements in a recollection of the summer. But it wouldn't be that hard to do that. You could just say one of the things that actually is a backdoor way of getting that is, what's the overnight minimum temperature at a location? And if you have a summer where you have really high overnight minimum temperatures, that's going to directly correlate with a summer that was very humid. So there is a sort of backdoor way of getting that information, but not a direct way of getting that, which is a curious fact and probably should be remedied.
Rich, thank you for calling. Carl in Verona, your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Does the energy in a hurricane, the kinetic energy of its winds, does that come totally from the latent heat of the water vapor as it condenses at the higher altitudes? Does that completely determine what the hurricane's strength is, or are there other sources of energy?
Well, that's a really good question.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take the first shot, and then John can correct me. But I mean, we usually talk about that the fuel that feeds the hurricane is the warm water that gets evaporated off the ocean surface and then condenses. And what that ends up doing, that energy, that fuel, is develop a dynamical system that causes pressure gradients that then drives the winds. And then the strength of the winds is really sort of, I think one might argue, indirectly driven by the surface water temperatures rather than directly. Does that make sense,
John? Yeah, that does. That makes good sense to me. One of the interesting things about hurricanes is that they really do rely on what Steve was talking about, and people formally call that air-sea interaction, that there's an enormous amount of heat energy that's contained in the warm water, and that gets tapped in the form of evaporative evaporation off the ocean, which invests the air with lots of water vapor. But as it does so, the pressure towards as the wind goes towards the center of the storm, the pressure drops so that the air doesn't really change its temperature very much. It just gets extra water vapor added to it, even though the evaporation would likely make a change. And so you end up with this huge reservoir of water vapor that's been evaporated off the warm ocean surfaces. And that is the primary motivating force for the energy that ends up manifesting itself as the winds in the hurricane. That's true.
Very interesting. Carl, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. A few minutes ago, your guest said that the storm surge is higher under a full moon, and I think what he's talking about is at high tide, which has nothing to do with whether it's a full moon. And the other issue or question that I have is, do they have data over hurricanes over, say, the last 20 years? My understanding is that in the last year or two, we're coming off it's following about a 15-year record low number of hurricanes hitting the continental United States.
All right. Steve, you want to take a shot there?
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant about the full moon is really about the high tide. So the high tide, higher water level is going to allow that water to go in inland further. I don't remember if there is an increase or decrease in the amount of hurricanes going landfall over the last 15 years or so. I remember reading a paper that they seem to be intensifying as they come onto land. But I don't remember if they're what the trends are. I don't know if John does.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't know if there's been anything systematic in that short period of time that can be discerned. Although 15 years ago, 2005, was a devastating, highly active Atlantic tropical season. So if you're using 2005 and 2019, let's say, as endpoints in a time series, it's going to look like there's been a decrease. I don't know if you expand it by time, whether or not some of our experts, friends that Steve and I have at the department would say that there's been a systematic decrease in the number of storms per year. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I suspect the answer is probably no.
No. Oh. Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from David. It said his family has always been very interested in weather. He remembers about 65 years ago when his grandfather, who was born in 1892, received it in the mail every day, a fold-out map with the most recent equal pressure lines and temperatures in the continental U.S. He was so interested, his grandfather got him on the mailing list. And sure enough, there was a map in the mail every day. Wondering, it sounds like you've heard about this, John.
Yeah, this is the daily map series from the National Weather Service. I don't think they mail them anymore. Now they put it online. But we have a whole collection of them down in our Schmertvega Library in our department building. They started doing that, boy, I don't even know when. It was sometime in the late 19th century. And, any private citizen could make a request to get the daily 7 a.m. Eastern Time surface analysis of sea level pressure and the 7 a.m. 500 millibar map on the other side. So people who had an interest in the weather used to get regularly nourished by taxpayer dollars on this. And I think this is a great thing. I wish we could still do it. And I think they still, as I say, do it online, but it doesn't have the same, you know, there's something great about getting a map in the mail, taking it out and drawing on it with pencils and so on and starting to pay attention to what's going on in the weather. So, yeah, he's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really – I did not know that. That's really cool. A listener emailed asking about a photo, and I think you guys got an email to you. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to see it, but it's a – amazing photo, the central shaft of this phenomenon was said to be lightning. This is not a time exposure.
Well, let's see. Wow, that is an amazing lightning photo. I mean, it looks like a white tree, right? I mean,
it's
the center bolt is so thick. And I'm going to guess that's a forest fire. I haven't read the whole caption here, but that's also then going on. That looks like a fire on the landscape there as well.
You wouldn't have wanted to have been right under that one.
Sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah. And they all said it's not a time exposure, so it's all in a relatively quick amount of time. Boy, that's amazing.
That is an amazing, amazing photo. Well, actually, that brings up this whole question about the weather, the fires, and all that's going on. These fires a part of the weather? You know, the reason for them, part of the weather, I assume, eh?
Yeah, I mean, in the West in particular, and California in particular as well, wildfires are, you know, part of the natural weather phenomena or ecosystem phenomena, maybe I put it that way. So there is always fire seasons in the West. And it comes about because that's the dry season, and so there's no precipitation. You might get a lightning bolt flash like the photo that was sent us, and that's probably on your Facebook page. Which would certainly start a fire. And then if it's dry and then winds come along as well, it can really pick that up and cause some really bad, intense forest fires. We are seeing, you know, with these warmer springs and summer temperatures and reduced snowpack, particularly the spring snowpack, not being around as longer, we are seeing more intense dry seasons in the West, and that's leading to a more susceptibility for severe wildfires and also lengthening the fire season, which has been estimated in the Saharas, I think, to be increased by more than a month now.
Man. Yeah. Nick in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Nick.
Talking about mailing, you guys are talking about mailing in the mats in the mail.
Yeah.
I'm in the ham radio, and we will monitor like the NOAA satellites, and you can download the maps from them.
And oh, we so just you can
satellite it to us.
All right, Nick. Thank you very much for calling. So you can download them from NOAA. Well. Another interesting. Let's look at. Your blog that you recently sent, I wanted to get to that. The ozone hole that we sometimes hear about, is that something that happens on both poles?
Yeah, it mostly occurs in Antarctica, and that has to do with primarily because the Antarctic continent is really high, and that leads to a situation in the upper atmosphere where you get a lot of coolings and then these polar vortex, which helps to get these stratospheric clouds to develop, polar stratospheric clouds to develop, where then that leads to the destruction of the ozone. It can occur in the Arctic. It's just not that common. Although this past spring up until March, I think, if I remember right, we did have a weaker ozone hole develop over the Arctic. And what that ozone hole means is that up in the stratosphere, where ozone is good to be because it protects us from UV light, as opposed to ozone near the ground, which isn't great because it's an air pollutant as well, we did get a small ozone hole develop, a reduction in the amount of ozone over the Arctic. So it can happen. It's just not as common as we see in the Antarctic, where it occurs every year.
Well, is that a concerning thing for us?
I haven't seen anything where people are overly concerned. It was the winter in which it formed, or after it formed, was a little bit unique type of winter. So you need those kind of unique wintertime situations in order to be able to set it up in the Arctic as well. And generally what we're seeing in the Antarctic is, you know, the loss of ozone in the Antarctic trend is to not be losing as much. So things are getting better, and they're getting better because the globe, the, you know, people across the globe got together and made the Montreal Protocol to try and change how we behave, the CFCs that we use, which were scientifically shown to be contributing to the loss of ozone down in the Antarctic.
So we can make a difference if we put our minds to it.
Caused the problem, so we can put our minds to it and change our behavior and therefore change our impact.
It turns out that people who spend their whole lives thinking about science problems actually know something about those problems, and they maybe ought to be listened to, remarkable as that may sound.
Wow. Well, what are you guys seeing for fall in terms of, the coming months here in terms of weather? What does it look like for us in general?
I must confess, I've not peeked ahead.
Yeah. I have opened the Farmer's Almanac, which has recently come out. And, John, you'll be happy to know.
I saw that at the store the other day.
They are predicting a cold
winter. Well, wow, what a surprise.
Right.
Who would have guessed?
They're predicting cold for the winter.
Is that what you would have guessed?
Well, Noah, I think
I did two things when I was a kid. I did two things when I was a kid every year. I predicted a Red Sox World Series victory, which never happened. And the other was I'd read the Farmer's Almanac and predict a cold, snowy winter, which almost never happened. So I don't have a lot of faith in it, as you know.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, Catherine, I know we may have time for this. Catherine emailed some photos of clouds that it looks like a roll of clouds coming in.
Oh, yeah. I was just looking at it now. That's an arc cloud that usually is out in front of a thunderstorm. And if you look at it, you can see the green sky below it, which tells you that that's probably a severe thunderstorm going on. And you see those clouds a lot of times with that burst of cool air that hits you before a thunderstorm comes, and it's riding right along the top of that gust front. That's what that looks like to me.
Yeah, it's another cool picture. I love it when we get these photos sent in to us. And people have come up with some dandies. Well, here we are out of time, guys. Thank you. The time flew by. Steve and John, thanks a lot for being with us today. And you'll be back the last Monday of next month. We'll do it all over again.
All right. We'll be looking forward to hearing you make a 900-yard punt.
Yeah. 900
to match
900
our forecast.
900 feet.
All right. Well,
bye. Steve Ackerman, John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences will be back the last Monday of next month. So we will look forward to that as well. Thank you guys all for listening, and please stay with us. The author of the book In Praise of Walking is on the show next. But for now, stay listening. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.